Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest Charity Digital podcast. Today is a really exciting podcast here for us at Charity Digital. For over 2 years now, we have had a brilliant relationship with the NCSC. They are working with us to help educate the sector the best way we can on any potential cyber attacks. For those of you who have joined us on previous NCSC webinars or podcasts, you'll know that the shocking statistic of 44% of charities aren't protecting themselves from cyber attacks because they don't see themselves at risk. We would all like to think that these hackers would leave the sector alone with the incredible work you are all doing, but unfortunately, this just isn't the case. Today, we were able to bring this to life. I am joined with Jerry Crowe from Mary Stevens Hospice. Jerry is the Director of Operations and Support, and he is here to share a story with us. Back in April 2019, Mary Stevens Hospice was victim to a cyber attack, and today, Jerry is going to bring the story to life. The hospice has allowed Jerry to talk openly and honestly about the experience today to help charities realise that no matter how small you are or how incredible your work is, you're still at risk. Alongside Jerry, I'm joined by the not-profit lead from National Cybersecurity Centre, who you should all know quite well, CUB. Welcome both of you.
Thank you.
Morning.
Morning. How are you all feeling today?
Really good, thank you, especially because today we've heard the vaccine's been approved, so it's a good day.
This is a good day, that's so true. As you all know, now Jerry's reminded me, we are all remote, so please do bear with us if there is any sound problems, but hopefully you can all hear us perfectly. Jerry, I think we should just come straight to you with this one and tell us what made you realise that something could be wrong back in April 2019.
Okay. If I can start maybe just by repeating something you said, because we were one of those charities. Everybody believed we were so small, we're perfectly harmless, we don't have lots of financial data, no one would bother us. And then in April 2019, if I'd tell you how it started, I was working from home on that day and a member of staff phoned me and she said, I think one of our computers has been hacked. And she told me the story, which I'll repeat in a minute. So I immediately phoned our IT company and they locked that computer down instantly for us. But what had happened the day before, a member of staff had received a good email. It came from Microsoft. It told her that her password needed to be changed. And there was a login box and it says, please enter your username. So she put her email address in there and your password. And then you'll be asked to enter your new password. She did that, but her password didn't change. Now, that was on the Tuesday. She didn't think anything about it. She just assumed that it was a Microsoft glitch. But actually, in hindsight, it transpired. That is the way a hacker got hold of her username and her ID. On the Wednesday, she had a couple of phone calls. First phone call from somebody who said about an email she'd sent out. And she just thought, strange person's got me in mistake with someone else. Another call, she thought, what's going on here? The world's full of nutters. People are phoning about emails not sending out. And then while she was having lunch, someone else phoned to another member of staff. And then the bell started ringing that something was going on. And at that point, once our IT company looked at it, a hacker had been on our system for at least 24 hours. He had access to her emails. He had changed rules on her. And excuse me, I'm not technical, so I'm perhaps not using the right terms. But he had changed the rules on her email so that the hacker was sending emails out. If you responded, the response didn't go into her email box, it went to the hacker. So had people not phoned, that potentially could have been going on for weeks and weeks and weeks. So that's how it all started. But at the time, we thought it was serious, but it was one of those things. It was the next day. Yeah. I sat down and spoke to the lady concerned. We had a discussion. And while I was there, I said, right, can I just look at your emails a minute? And as I was there, an email popped up and I said to her, what's that? And she said, oh, that's a screen print from another program we use called Formstack. And that included an individual's name, full name, credit card, full number, the expiry date, the CCV date or CSV number, yeah. which frightened me straight away. Why have you got this? And she said to me, oh, don't worry, Jerry, we've been doing this for years. And I went, but what do you do with it? And she explained to me, email comes in, they enter it on this other system on WorldPay. I said, and then you delete it. She said, no, look. And she showed me these files going back for years and years and years. And we immediately realized we had a major problem on our hands. But and we don't know for certain. We don't know if the hacker saw all that detail, copied that detail. There was no way of us telling, but we treated this as the hacker could have seen everything and included, could have accessed our database of all of our donors, some 35,000 people.
Yeah.
So that's really just the background to it.
No, I think that's really helpful. And Jerry, like you say, it all started just by a password change, which I think is something that we've all kind of done naturally. I remember I used to get loads about my Facebook and it was like, your Facebook password's expired, you need to change it, but nothing would ever happen. And I remember ages ago, Cub, you told us how they get you through those platforms to see if you use the same password elsewhere. And we are all guilty of doing that. So it is quite interesting to hear kind of your how that is just everyday normality and what kind of transpired from that. Jerry, did you already have a protocol, like a system in place if something was going to happen like this?
We did. It's like a lot of people, I think. We have policies in place, but it's, you know, no one ever read the policies. And there was this misconception that if you think your computer's been hacked, switch it off straight away. But all we knew was if something happened, we phoned the experts because we don't have any integral IT support. We're supported by an outside IT company. And so if there's a problem, first call, go to them, and then we start reporting it internally because they are the experts.
Yeah. Cub, I can see you're nodding your head here. Is this something that you've had before? Is this a unique experience?
I would love to tell you that it's a unique experience and I've never heard this happen before. You know, for me, those are the really kind of interesting ones in a lot of ways. But sadly, I've heard a version of Jerry's story so many times. But I think, first off, I do just want to say how I think the right word is brave it is for your hospice to come out and talk about this. You know, I've had a lot of confidential conversations with charities and businesses in exactly the same position as you, but there is an almost, I think, taboo about coming out and, you know, owning up and saying, look, we got this happened, you know, we did some things wrong, we fell victim to an attack and we're learning from it. And not a lot of organizations are kind of happy saying that. But yes, unfortunately, we have seen this a lot. It's almost got to the point now where this is the kind of the run of the mill. It's something we see every day. We get reports like this through Action Fraud and through NCSE's own incident management team. And it's not just small organisations that this happens to. You know, I've seen some of the largest organisations in the UK, their staff volunteers have fallen for exactly the same attack. And it's because, like you say, it was a really legitimate looking email to someone who's just trying to get on and do their job as best they can. They go, oh, okay, fine. IT's asking me to reset my password. There must be a problem. It looks legitimate. It, in your case, looks like it's from Microsoft. I'll do it quickly and then I can get back to work. And it's not surprising that this is so common because it plays on a very normal thing for us to do. So no, unfortunately, we do see it happening a lot. I think in the most recent cybersecurity breaches survey, phishing emails like this accounted for around 80% of all of the attacks that people had seen over the previous year. So I think that probably gives a bit of an indication of how common this is for organisations. You know, even this week, I was flicking through my junk folder the other day, and I saw about 4 or 5 emails that are quite clearly trying to trick me into doing something that's not in my best interest. Thankfully, my junk folder's pretty militant and takes out all of the emails that it can. Quite often, legitimate ones end up in there. But I think for me, that's probably the better course of action.
Yeah, definitely. Jerry, let's go back to the incident. So once your charity found out that this had happened, what was kind of your next steps? You said that you got in contact with the IT team, they kind of shut it down.
Yeah.
But what kind of did you do next?
Right, on the Thursday morning, so Wednesday when I learned about it, I phoned the CEO, you know, and not overly concerned. On the Thursday morning, I was very concerned. Mm. I went back, spoke to the chief executive officer and some members of executive board. Yeah. And the initial feeling was, right, let's keep this in-house. Let's see what we can do. So after speaking to people who thought we could keep it in-house, I thought it's best to phone the ICO helpline. So I phoned them, but it was an anonymous phone call. I didn't tell them who I was or where I was phoning from. And I gave them the scenario, and they were really helpful. And once I told them everything, they actually said to me, right, just ask yourself this one question. Why wouldn't you report it? And what would happen if someone else reported it?
Yeah.
So I then took that message back to the CEO and others, and we sat down and spoke about it. And even at that point, not everybody was in agreement that we should report it. But we took the decision then and there we would report it formally to the ICO. I then phoned them back and this time said who I was, where I was phoning from. And all I can say is everything I'd heard previously about the ICO was they were horrors. They'd rip us to pieces. They didn't. They gave us advice. It was all very calm. Have you done this? Have you done this? Have you considered doing this? And I just found them throughout the whole process really helpful. I felt very confident by my third phone call. I could phone up and say, look, I'm not an expert. What do I do? Does this sound right? And they just all seemed to want to help us.
Yeah, I think that goes back to what Cub was saying, how brave it is to be able to come out and talk about it now. And that shows the transition since your first phone call of making that anonymous tip of just being like, I just need some support of what might happen. I'm not really sure if you're ready to talk about it or if you think you need to. I think that's so good to be able to say that you did that, to find out what kind of was out there for you.
Definitely. I mean, I've heard, you know, speaking at conferences and things like that, that myth around the ICO and regulators in general, it's not unique to the ICO. But I've got to say, you know, in working very closely with the ICO as NCSC does on proactive things, we won't report people to the ICO. That's not our role at all. But working with them on kind of proactive guidance and things like that, they are an incredibly helpful organisation. And I think where you're open and honest and transparent with them from the beginning, much the same as kind of Jerry has just described, they are there to help. Ultimately, they are sort of the guardian of data within this country. They just want to make sure that everything that can be done to protect it is being done. And I think, you know, I'm really pleased to kind of hear that was Jerry's experience as well. Kind of been an easy phone call initially, but I'm glad that, you know, they were helpful and kind of supportive once you got over that initial hurdle.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's safe to say we all need more Jerrys in the world to take that initiative. And it's really, really good that you've been able to do that. Obviously, you had that fear of kind of reporting it as a charity and what kind of that would do to you reputational wise and everything like that. What has been, like, in reality, what has been the result of your reporting?
There was a lot of hard work. So what we decided to do, because even to this day, no, we don't know, did the hacker get onto our DonorFlex data system? Mm-hmm. So everybody on that system, we wrote an individual letter to 35,000 people.
Gosh.
And we were worried our reputation would suffer, our income through fundraising would suffer. And I'll be honest with you, we got some quite upset and irate people phoning me, writing to me, and we kept, and it was agreed that everything would come to me. So everybody was getting the same line. But we also had a lot of people saying, thank you very much. You know, it's nice that you're honest about this.
Yeah, holding your hands up.
Yeah. We even had one lady who wrote and said, really sorry to hear this has happened to you. My dad died in your hospice 3 years ago and we promised him we'd give you some money. We totally forgot. Here's a £3,000 check. But we did have people who said to us, right, remove my details from your database. We never want to hear from you again. And our numbers on our database dropped dramatically. However, our income didn't. And what in hindsight transpired was we were writing to 35,000 people and perhaps only 5,000 were actually responding. As we all do it, we throw the letters in the bin when we get them from charities. Our efforts are now very much directed more towards those who want to support us. So we were probably wasting a lot of money on mailing out to people who were just putting it in via bin.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
But the it actually cost us approximately £15,000 cash, not in time and effort, because I don't know what that we didn't add that up. But we had to pay for the mail shot. We had to pay for legal advice. We had to get extra technical support to get things changed. But it was, we believe it was money well spent.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for sharing this.
We've got this, and especially me, I've got it in my head that the day I want help, hopefully someone's going to help me. And all of the charities, we're all doing something to help other people. Yeah. Actually, this will help other charities out, we hope. And we know it internally. Straight away, we reported to Hospice UK. We put it on the network, what happened.
Yeah, because that's the thing, though. It's all kind of, it's everything that you do naturally without thinking about. And especially now we're all working from home, it's a lot easier, I think, to just be like, oh, I'll just save this on my desktop, or I'll just create a folder for that. And I think we're all guilty of that, but it's the fear of actually what happens if something goes wrong,
and then
being able to handle it afterwards. And you say it cost that approximately 15,000 to fix. However, if you hadn't have reported it to the ICO, mm-hmm. and you had of as someone else had have reported it, do you know what that fine would have been?
With GDPR, when that came out, the fines were increased dramatically. And I can't remember what percentage of income it works out at. But at the time, I looked at that and I said, actually, had we not reported it and the ICO had found out, we could have been potentially been fined up to £250,000.
Gosh.
So it was money well spent. And on the other side of that, our reputation would have gone totally downhill, because then as a charity, we'd be seen to be hiding things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that is it. It is crazy. It's brilliant. And like Cup was saying, that the ICO are there to protect the data, and how, and the difference in kind of, we probably do have some charities that probably have had a different experience with the ICO. Mm-hmm. And obviously every experience is unique, but it shows how by being forthcoming that relationship with them is going to be a lot easier, and they want to help you make a change. I can't believe this only just happened in April 2019. It would be great to know kind of what else have you done. So you made that initial change, you spent that initial money, but mm-hmm. what else has happened since then?
Right. We asked our IT company afterwards, and we had to pay extra to actually carry out an analysis of what happened. And they looked into it, and it did boil down to, however much technical support we have there, if the individual's not being wary of these attacks, we're going to be open to them. But our IT company suggested a lot of technical changes. So, for instance, previously, I could have forwarded my work emails to my Yahoo account. And that's how the hacker did it. I'm not saying it was a Yahoo account, but the hacker forwarded the emails to Hotmail, Yahoo, AOL or something. On our systems now, we can forward our emails to another @marystevenshospice.co.uk address, but we can't send it out of a system. It just technically won't allow us to do that. Emails coming in from outside. So when you've sent me an email, Mimi, it will always, there's this great big red banner on the top which says external email. This has come from someone outside your organization. And that was because, and we had seen them before. I think they're called CEO phishing. It looks like it's come from a CEO, but it's coming from outside.
Yeah.
And it's very obvious to us what's coming in from outside. And also our IT company have really tightened up our spam filter. So every morning I come into work, there's an email from Microsoft saying the following emails have been blocked and we can either just view it, have a look at it and view it. If you know it's safe, you can release it or you can block it. So lots of technical things, and we've educated staff as well. So one of the things we do now is we pay for another company called Nowhere Before to carry out phishing exercises. So every so often, I tend to do it every 4 to 6 weeks, we have a phishing email will go out to our staff, and they are random emails going out at random times. And then I'll get a report back saying who clicked, who opened the email, and who entered data. So they might have entered their password. And any of those staff, we then put on extra training on that portal. And quite a few of the staff say, oh, can we send that home? Because our kids, my husband, my wife wants to see it because it's good in work and out of work. But we try to stick to a policy of it's, I know one day I will do it.
Yeah.
However wary I am going to be the person to click on that email that might open us up to someone outside. So on our inductions, we brief staff about this. We tell them, you know, we're not trying to catch you out. We're just making you aware. The statistics we've been given that in the third sector with companies of our size, it's about 39% of staff who click on emails, you know, phishing emails. We initially were around about 30, 32%. We're now down to 5%.
That is brilliant.
So it is working. But we try to say, just report it. If you do it wrong, report it and we can action it. We're not into punishing people, because if we did that, you'd end up punishing the CEO, the finance director, myself, for it's not blatant disregard. It's an error.
So yeah.
The lady who actually caused the hack to begin with, there were lots of calls, lots of, you know, some of her calls, oh, she should be sacked, she should be sacked. No, she made a mistake. And as soon as she became aware she had made the mistake, it was reported. And we was concerned that if we took really severe disciplinary action against her, all it would do would scare other people. Well, I'm not going to report myself because they're going to sack me, fine me. So,
I think that makes so much sense, because what you're doing there is creating a safe space. Because I think that's part of the problem. Like you said earlier, you almost will, as a charity, you were scared, not scared, but you were nervous to report to the ICO because you didn't kind of want to get the repercussions of that. And that's the same thing internally, I feel, as a kind of young, junior member of staff or even a higher member of staff, you get a bit anxious about saying that you've done something wrong, and because you're worried about what the repercussions might be. And I think if you're creating that safe environment where people feel like they can come to you, come to anyone, come to a colleague and just have that conversation and be like, I think I've done something wrong, they're more likely to report it then keep it under their belt. And if they keep it quiet, that's where things can go wrong. Because if your colleague hadn't initially called you and you hadn't created that environment for her to feel like she could, anything could have happened from that point initially. So I think it's brilliant that you've covered that. I think this is all really interesting, because I feel like these are the questions that people say. They say, is it worth me spending that initial money to kind of make sure that, to try and support that something like this won't happen to me? Or is it, again, then you have that next question where you're at a crossroads where you're like, should I report it and have to pay out? Or should I wait and see if anyone else reports it? Because we may not have to pay a fine because it may not be a problem.
Yeah.
And then you're at your next crossroads where you're like, okay, we've now done all this. And I think the next question to you, Jerry, is, does that mean that you're 100% secure now because you've put those procedures in place?
No, definitely not. I'm a great believer in no one is 100% secure. It was a question I got asked by our trustees recently. And I've said, you know, if the CIA, the White House, the UK government get hacked, we are not 100% secure and no one can be. However, if we are hacked again, we can give clear evidence that we have tried to make ourselves as secure as we can within our resources. You know, we don't have a finite sum of money, so it's been done on the cheap because some other companies will be spending tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of pounds on it.
Yeah.
But for a charity, I believe we are as secure as we can be, and every member of staff is aware of our stance on security of data.
Yeah. Which I think is almost that last part of your staff being aware is almost priceless, because that's everything that you've put in place already and you're continuing to improve that process. I think that's a big thing. It's maintaining the security mm-hmm. process as things have changed.
Yeah.
And how you then keep communicating that to your staff to make sure they're kind of involved in that process. And like you say, it's not just something that happens in the workplace. It's also something that happens at home. So for them to be taking it home with them as well means they're constantly having that, like it's in their subconscious now, because they want their family to be secure, as yep. secure as they are. I think that it's brilliant what you have done. You should be very proud of the hospice, and also to be able to talk about it is incredible.
Yeah. And sometimes I'll be the first to admit, sometimes it can be a real pain. You know, people are like, I've got this email, Joe, can you have a look? What do you think about it? And I'll say to them simple things, remember what was on the training, just float your mouse over who it's from. And actually you'll see perhaps it's not from that person and what have you. And we've used, there's a lot of free technical support available from Microsoft, which a lot. So, and I'll give you an example. Just this morning, I've updated some financial data onto SharePoint. I have received an email back that says, I have put in something that may be a credit card number in there. Now, I've done it myself, so I am 100% clear. I haven't got anyone except for my own credit card.
Yeah.
But because there's a lot of figures and data in there, Microsoft, the system, seems to think I have put in a credit card number. So I've probably done four figures.
Yeah.
And it's given me a warning.
That's good.
And it's automatic. We're not paying any extra for that.
Yeah, and that's what you've just set up in your kind of Microsoft Outlook settings.
I haven't personally. Our IT company have done that for us. I wouldn't know how to.
No, I wouldn't know where to start with that either.
Absolutely.
This podcast is sponsored by the National Cybersecurity Centre, the government agency responsible for cybersecurity. They help protect the UK from cyber attacks, manage major cyber incidents, and provide advice to citizens and organisations on how to keep themselves secure online. Its vision is to help make the UK the safest place to live and work online. For more information, visit www.ncsc.gov.uk/charity.
Okay, well, just to let our listeners know, we actually lost Cub during that last session between Jerry and I. We carried on going because obviously things don't stop when you're working virtually, but Cub has joined us back and he is joining us from his car down the road from the house because he has lost all internet in his house and in his area. So Cub, welcome back. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Back to us. So our listeners, the sound quality may have slightly changed, but we're good to carry on. So while you were gone, Cub, we spoke a bit about creating that safe space for your staff members, kind of telling them off. Jerry said that since the reporting incident happened, they've created this environment where they have the phishing emails that go out to their staff. And if anyone comes back to say, I think I've done something wrong, there is no telling off there, which I think is probably music to your ears. Is there anything that you would say that they can do in addition to that? Any charity should put in place? Anything, any resources that people should go to?
Absolutely. I mean, that is completely music to my ears. And I think it is really difficult post-incident to not take a really hard line with people and think, okay, well, we're just going to start, you know, blaming people or kind of making our users the scapegoats. And actually at a conference probably about a year back now, I put that question out to the audience and said, what do you do if your staff click on phishing emails or they do something wrong with their IT or things like that? And someone sort of put their hand up and thought they were going to give a really sort of good answer that I was hoping to hear, and sort of said, well, what we do is we get them in a room quite similar to this and I yell at them for 20 minutes about why they put the organization at risk and how actually, you know, if they do it again, this is going to be a formal disciplinary. And I sort of, you know, you have to approach that conversation quite gently in a kind of conference environment. But ultimately, all that does is put your staff back up. It makes them afraid of being honest about, you know, genuine mistakes that they've made. You know, clicking on a phishing email, everyone is going to do it. I've done it. Our technical director wrote a blog about a phishing email he very nearly fell for, and he's, you know, one of the UK's see anyone can. So, I mean, it's great to hear that kind of post-incident you've taken that really, we call it a just culture, so where everybody feels like their actions are justified and that they're going to be treated with, you know, respect and kind of support if they do something wrong. I think we have an e-learning package called Top Tips for Staff. It's a 20-minute free-to-use e-learning package that takes staff through what they can look out for, what cyber attacks look like, because I'm guessing, you know, in Jerry's case, a lot of the staff didn't really know what a cyber attack was or how they happened, or even, you know, that Microsoft email could have been one. So it's about just educating people on that. But actually just doing those simulated phishing that Jerry's doing is a really valuable tool. You know, sometimes the staff become a bit wise to it. I've heard of organisations who make a bit of a competition out of it, who can spot the most fake phishing emails. It's quite an interesting competition because then the IT people come and look at it and go, we didn't send any of those. So you've also managed to, you know, grab some realistic ones, some real ones out of that as well. So it's a really great approach and kind of great to hear that that positive culture is being adopted within the hospice.
That is brilliant. You could make like a virtual scoreboard of who's got the most phishing emails. I think we've all got that human error side of things. We got a couple of emails, and I remember one day in the office, this was when we were allowed to be in the office, one of our team were putting their coat on and they were like, oh, I've got to go out and buy Apple vouchers. Jonathan's just emailed me to go and buy Apple vouchers, scratch off the back of them and photocopy over the codes to him. And we were like, what? Why would he want Apple vouchers? And why is he emailing you? Like, this is so random. Like, let's talk about this a bit more. And it was like, actually, and I knew that Jonathan was at a university with his daughter. So I was like, this just seems very odd. Like, I don't think this is something he would ask for. Like, let's look at it a bit more. And that was just because we were all in the office and saw them get up and be like, and then they were chatting about what they were going to do, like you would. Whereas virtually, I feel like it's a lot harder to do that. You don't notice it. You just pop out, do your own little thing. So I think it's really good to keep that kind of communication up internally about kind of anything that's coming along. And if you don't feel comfortable saying it to like a line manager, saying it to you, but say it to your colleague or something like that, because everyone's got that colleague in the office that they can have those conversations with. So it's really good to create that. We were then discussing how Jerry got asked if now the charity is 100% secure. And obviously no one is 100% secure. So Cub, is there anything that kind of you can add to that and talk about on that side of things? We're never going to be 100% secure, but we can all kind of get there in some way. So yeah, it'd be great to hear your thoughts there.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true. No one is 100% secure. And also, one of the things that I think I'm hoping this podcast and kind of Jerry's story gets across is that nobody is immune to falling victim either. So one of the first talks I ever did, somebody kind of came up to me afterwards and said, you know, that was really interesting. And in principle, I think I agree with kind of all of the bits you said, but, you know, we're a small charity. We're doing little bits of research into, you know, a cure for cancer or treatments for cancer. Surely they are not going to come after us. And I felt awful bursting this person's bubble to say, actually, they don't really, well, two things. They either don't care that you're a charity trying to cure cancer or find treatments for it, or they just don't know. And quite often these, you know, particularly something like the Microsoft phishing email that Jerry described, goes out to so many different people from a list of emails that they have no idea whether you're a charity, an individual, a business, government even. And therefore they don't necessarily even know that they're potentially defrauding a charity. So I think, you know, it is right to say that nobody can be 100% secure, but there are some, you know, free or at least low cost steps that all charities can take. Those are
particularly for smaller charities, going through our small charity guide, which is the kind of five areas that you can really focus on to improve your cybersecurity, is a really good step. And that's kind of getting the fundamentals right. And it's called the Small Charity Guide because it's typically the right guidance for smaller charities. But actually, I've spoken to a lot of much larger charities who still need to get those basics in place. Yeah. But I think for the larger charities that might be listening to this, I'd probably point you to two things. The first of which is our board toolkit, which is about getting the governance right at a board and exec team level. And I think part of Jerry's story that resonated with me was that initial resistance from the exec team to highlight anything that could be potentially damaging. And that board toolkit takes the board, who, you know, typically are not technical experts, and the same the majority of the time for the executive team as well, through the sort of universal governance principles around cybersecurity without assuming any technical knowledge, and actually provides them with the right questions to be able to challenge technical experts, talk to staff about cybersecurity. And then for the more technical people within your organization, we have something called 10 steps. Is just a really kind of useful, it's got 10 steps, it's in the name, but it's a really useful kind of tour through the technical measures that you need to have in place to have a good level of security for a sort of larger organization. It's a bit more risk-based than perhaps the small charity guide, which is much more kind of, these are the five things, get them right, and see how you get on.
Brilliant. That is perfect. I think that is a great place for us to wrap up. I'm not sure if there are any last words, Jerry, that you want to pass on from your incredible experience to other charities listening today.
I think probably just it's a journey that everyone's going to have to go through at some point. One of the things, quotes I heard when it happened to us, and I was looking at something online, and the quote was, you're either a business that's been hacked and know it, or a business that's been hacked and you don't know it. We know it, so we've taken a number of steps. Our latest step was we've gone down the NCSC Cyber Essentials Plus route, and we decided to do that so we had someone totally external of our IT company, external of us, who would come in and assess how secure we were. And we now have that external accreditor saying your IT company's as secure as it can be, you're as secure as you can be. And now we can advertise that to all our potential donors, our contractors, that, you know, your data is not 100% safe. It never will be, but we have made it as safe as we can.
Yeah. I think that's brilliant. And I think that is a lovely place to end. Thank you both so much for joining me today. I really hope that we have got this message across to our listeners and that everyone is going to be able to feel that safe space within their charities. But yes, thank you so much. Okay. And we'll see you next time.
All right. Cheers, Mimi. Thank you.